The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
U.S. intelligence officials are now redoubling efforts to investigate the origins of COVID-19.
President Biden is requesting an ambitious budget from Congress, boosting government spending to its highest level in decades. The budget would cost $6 trillion.
I think Bitcoin's greatest risk is its success. Let's say people want to sell their bonds and they want to buy Bitcoin. The more that happens, then it goes into Bitcoin and it doesn't go into credit, and then they lose control of it. So yeah, that's a risk.
Ford announcing they are going to be increasing their investment in EVs and AVs. That will now be $30 billion through 2025. They also have an update on the F-150 Lightning that they unveiled last week. They now say that the reservations top 70,000.
If you look at the history of epidemics, serious epidemics, it typically takes a couple of years. And here I think it'll be a little bit like the roaring 20s of the 20th century, but now in the 21st century. Because understandably, people will be very relieved when this is all finally over, right? People have been cooped up one way or another for a very long time. We're going to get a little taste of it, I think, this summer.
More than 34 million Americans are expected to hit the road this Memorial Day weekend. American adults, half of whom are vaccinated, are eager to fulfill travel plans that were sidelined last year due to the health crisis.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Throughout the last few weeks, there has been sort of a tug of war on many catalysts that are driving factors of market sentiment overall, but no real conviction in either direction, and a running correction in stocks has persisted. Those factors are some of the following. Based on investor response to positive earnings in April and May, the consensus has been that good news has been priced into the market. Economics and earnings growth will soon peak. There's been a move down in treasury yields, that this move can't be trusted, and rates will soon head higher again because of inflationary fears and deficit concerns. Central banks are going to have to start withdrawing their excessive policy accommodation. We know that based on the FOMC minutes last week, which finally showed they are talking about possibly tapering purchases. Despite COVID vaccination progress in the U.S., many other countries are still seeing a surge in coronavirus cases. However, just recently I was talking with Chris Poplava, who showed me a chart of Bloomberg, which speaks otherwise. The active cases are actually falling for the first time in months, down to 51.5 million active cases, but down for the first time in months. Valuations are stretched and or will be challenged with an uptick in interest rates. Let's see. Traders have been saying the downtick in treasury yields is mainly related to short covering. However, why would yields drop on some of the biggest inflationary news points we've seen year to date on Friday? It doesn't make a lot of sense right now. The Fed's preferred inflationary gauge is the PCE price index, which rose 0.6% in April versus the previous month. Now, up 3.6% year over year. The core PCE price index, that's without food, without energy, was also up 0.7%. The last year-over-year measure in March was an increase of 2.4%. And before that, 1.9%. So inflation is accelerating month to month. Costco's CFO said inflationary factors abound and stated price inflation at the selling level is in the 2.5% to 3.5% range, but above expectations. We also got inflationary expectations Friday from the Michigan Index of Consumer Sentiment showing year-ahead inflation, that's what we're anticipating a year from now, will be at a rate of 4.6%, the highest rate on record for the measure. Given this information, 10-year Treasury yield bond rates didn't go up on Friday, they went down. And from the peak, since we've seen in the Treasury yield this year, about right around 1.75% has come down to 1.58. I'm not sure that makes sense, but according to many bond-savvy investors, back on March 8th, if you recall, David Tepper and Mohamed El-Erian agreed with each other that yields were probably very attractive to foreign investors, and we should see them step in a bigger way. That may be the case. I definitely agree, as if you take a look at Japanese bond yields, they've barely budged in the last year. German bond yields, still negative. Moving on, some of the peak growth concerns were assisted by the new home sales for April, which declined 5.9% versus March. Fewer and fewer homes priced under $399,000 are selling, and the ones that are selling at higher costs, above $500,000, continue to rise. The Case-Shiller Home Price Index was up 13.3% year-over-year in March, following a revised 12% increase in February, so prices are accelerating there. Shifting gears, I wanted to focus your attention to the retailer earnings released on Wednesday, which drove up the retail stocks. Dick's Sporting Goods, Urban Outfitters, and Abercrombie & Fitch all announced, up 17%, 10%, and 7.8% respectively, during the driving the retail ETF XRT up 2.9% on the day for a great showing. Amazon that day also confirmed its purchase of MGM Studios for $8.45 billion, its second largest acquisition after Whole Foods in the last few years. That will contribute about 4,000 films and about 17,000 TV shows. The view on the acquisition is that Amazon hasn't been able to produce original content at the speed of its competitors. You've got Disney, you've got Netflix, all producing their own content at possibly a faster speed. And Amazon needs to maybe catch up a little bit. Lastly, on the fiscal spending front, Thursday, the Senate Republicans counteroffered a $928 billion infrastructure plan to the $1.7 trillion American Jobs Plan. While there were reports the same day that Biden will propose a $6 trillion budget for next year, including both his plans, the American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan. Coupled with news that the jobless claims were down 38,000, bodes well for cyclical sectors and was contributing factor to the rise in the 10-year yield up to 1.61% that day, up 4 basis points. But that's it for this week. You know, the volatility index has fallen significantly. We're down to, I think, what, 16? Many of the other indices are testing resistance levels. The NASDAQ continues to rise. And some conflicting sentiment continues to kind of fight each other for conviction over inflation, whether it's transitory or not. Look at the bond market. Doesn't think so. You talk to the Federal Reserve voters. They don't think that inflation is here to stay. But again, look at those inflationary indices that keep coming out. Even the PCE price index, which is favored by the Fed, show otherwise. So we'll have to just continue to follow the inflationary story. But the biggest question right now is, who will flinch first, the Fed or inflation?
In February of last year, just after the S&P 500 made a new all-time high, Dr. Nada Sanders, global supply chain expert and forecaster, predicted on our show that COVID would send the global economy into a deep recession that year in 2020. FS Insider caught up with her again this week to get an update on her view, particularly on the outlook for inflation. Here's a clip of what she told listeners this week on FS Insider.
I do think that we are going into an inflationary period. I know that the economists are saying that that is not the case. I know that the economists are saying that what we are observing right now, what we saw here in the U.S. most recently with the consumer price index, far bigger than was expected. We are told, okay, it's a blip. However, I think it will be with us for a while. And I'm going to tell you why. Again, we have to look at the global picture. You know, when you look at so many shortages, so many of these supply chains, most notably the chip industry or semiconductor, you look and you see the broad impact that it's having.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management is hedging for rising inflation with a diversified strategy in commodities, precious metals, and inflation-protected bonds. Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you.
Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management. Diversification does not assure a profit or protection against loss. The value of investments, as well as any investment income, is not guaranteed and can fluctuate based on market conditions.
Well, the S&P is up about 12%. Looks like another good year for stocks. How long will this continue? What impact will inflation have on the markets? Let's find out with Gina Martin Adams from Bloomberg. She's the equity strategist there. Gina, let's talk about the stock market. So far, we've had a good year, but today the Biden administration announced that they're assuming the capital gains rates of 44% will be effective in April. In your opinion, will that have any impact on the market?
First, let me just say thanks for having me. I do think that tax at large will have any impact. There are two issues that I think will impact the market over the course of the next 6 months pretty severely, and those could be inflation as well as the infrastructure plan and how we're going to pay for it, which is, of course, via tax increases, mostly targeted at corporations as well as investors, it appears. So I do think that a capital gains rate increase could have pretty strong impact on the market. It's questionable as to whether or not it really depletes the overall market uptrend or just creates a degree of volatility. What we did see in the past is years in which capital gains tax was increased did create a downshift in the rate of appreciation for stocks as opposed to an outright massive correction in stocks. And so I think that's a reasonable expectation, is that you have volatility, particularly around year end. But if it's retroactive to April, that volatility may be significantly earlier than year end. So it's a work in progress. But frankly, if we're going to spend as much as we're planning to spend on infrastructure, we're going to have to pay for it somehow. And I do think that the biggest targets to pay for it are going to be corporations via a corporate income tax increase and potentially investors via capital gains increase.
So the other risk the market's looking at is inflation. We've certainly seen it in some of the recent numbers, PPI, CPI. You've got commodity prices, whether you're looking at lumber, copper, or corn. Now, the Fed and the administration says these are transitory as the economy starts up again. Do you buy the transitory theory, or do you think this could be the beginning of an inflation cycle?
Yeah, I'm still undecided on that, to be honest with you. Frankly, whether they're transitory or not, they are going to have an impact in the short run. So what I'm trying to spend the bulk of my attention on is what that impact is likely to be in the short run and how we navigate that impact. That said, I am open to the idea that this could be the beginning of a pretty significant inflation regime shift. I mean, obviously, we've seen record levels of fiscal spending as a share of GDP. We've just not experienced this degree of federal intervention in economic growth in our past. It's really difficult to claw that back. Similarly, with monetary policy expansion we saw in 2020, we have yet to claw any of that back. At the same time, the unemployment rate has recovered within a year what it took 4.5 years for the unemployment rate to recover following the great financial crisis. And the recovery has been very rapid and very robust. Many of the issues that are impacting inflation right now do appear to be supply chain based. So the question then is, well, how much of that is supply chains that will be reinvigorated over the course of recovery and how much will not? And that still is a question very much to be answered in part by how quickly we can get the world vaccinated. I think there are areas of the world where we are still somewhat supply chain dependent, where you're still experiencing uncomfortable rates of pandemic infections, where vaccines have yet to be broadly distributed, and that's creating even greater turmoil there. Certainly some of this, though, is the standard sort of demand recovery that is much faster than supply can keep up with. Eventually, supply will come on board and ease some of that pressure. But given the structural sort of changes and the amount of just money that we're flooding at the economy at the federal level and from monetary body, I do think that we need to start clawing some of that back sooner rather than later, or risk moving into a big inflationary regime change.
How would you contrast this kind of recovery compared to, let's say, the financial crisis? When we came out of the financial crisis, the Fed lowered interest rates. They started QE. But Gina, as you know, a lot of that money stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed. Contrast that to today, where the Fed is injecting all this liquidity with QE, but also government is basically, from helicopter drops, putting money directly into the economy.
Yeah, it's just night and day. I mean, I think it's almost irrelevant to reference the financial crisis, even though all of us do it naturally because it's our last crisis experience. It's nearly irrelevant to compare for a lot of reasons. The ones that you mentioned are just a few of those reasons. One other reason that comes immediately to mind is just the nature of growth going into the financial crisis versus the nature of growth and expectations going into this crisis. If you think about the years leading up to the financial crisis, we had this massive commodity boom. We also had this massive housing boom. I think many people would struggle to find any booms, big booms in the economy beyond technology headed into this crisis. So the sort of real economic conditions upon which the crisis evolved were totally different. There also was an obvious buildup of excess in the economy prior to the financial crisis, which we had to repair. You know, you think about things like household debt reaching all-time highs relative to income and extraordinary levels of debt service that households were undertaking as a share of income leading into the great financial crisis that we then spent the next 10 years sort of recovering, recuperating, sort of working off that excess. That didn't exist prior to the coronavirus-induced crisis in 2020. There was no natural economic event that created the crisis in 2020. It was an event created by an anomalous impact of a pandemic where governments responded by shutting down economies. And so naturally, the recovery process has likewise been completely different. Governments spent, you know, the federal government spent 20% of GDP. And that's just, that's an insane number relative to what we had in 2009, which was just a blip on the radar. The monetary body also tripled the size of the balance sheet in the course of just a few months in the spring of 2020. That certainly didn't happen when we were experimenting with QE following the great financial crisis. So they're just night and day, almost not comparable on a lot of measures, which makes this environment very challenging for investors because this was not a standard recession, nor was it a financial crisis that created a recession. It was a completely anomalous experience in historical perspective.
I want to turn our attention to real estate for a moment because I don't know what it's like in New York, but Gina, here in California, I mean, you put a house for sale, it could be sold in a weekend with bidding wars. You've got homes that are 1,300 square feet built 50 years ago going for almost $1 million. In fact, The standard definition of a millionaire in California is a homeowner.
Yeah, I think that California is always a proxy for crazy real estate experiences nationwide. That said, we are seeing an inordinate amount of activity in the housing markets. We may already be getting to a point, though, where we're starting to see rates rising and prices rising at a pace that results in a little bit of friction evolving in the housing markets as well. I mean, we've seen just this week pending home sales fell in the month of April. I believe I saw last week new home sales also fell in the month of April. Could that be a symptom of too little supply? Could it also be a symptom of rising rates and really rapid rises in prices that sort of box out certain new entrants to the housing market? Absolutely. So I think it's TBD where we go nationwide in terms of housing, but there's no doubt that the extremely low interest rates combined with a rapid recovery in economic growth have created an environment where house prices were rising at an extraordinary pace and are eventually going to create, it'll eventually create an environment where we just don't have enough demand to sustain those price increases, particularly if the Fed starts to taper, if we start to see longer term interest rates continue to rise and the like.
What about, how would you play this inflation cycle? You know, we've seen energy do well. We've seen materials do well. Things like precious metals, gold, silver are doing well. How would you play this?
Yeah. So our broader strategy since the middle of last year has been to rotate into value away from growth and into financials, industrials, materials, away from technology, healthcare, consumer stocks. It wasn't entirely due to an inflation call. I think there are other reasons to see that kind of rotation play out in our sector scorecards as well as factor scorecards. But inflation should only amplify those trends. What we really care about with inflation is the degree to which producer prices are being passed along to consumer prices. Inflation is not always a bad thing for stocks. As a matter of fact, most of the time, inflation is generally absorbed in the equity market very well, and prices tend to rise and earnings tend to rise with inflation. Even S&P 500 margins tend to rise as inflation rises. But when you get to a point in time where producer prices are rising so quickly that companies are failing, are increasingly failing to pass those price increases on to consumers, then you start to encounter trouble. That's the point that we hit this spring. So what you've typically seen following points in time in which producer prices rose at the pace of, you know, any pace above 2% on a core basis, and then any points in time when producer prices are rising faster than consumer prices by more than 200 basis points annually, you tend to see margins start to contract on the index. The margin weakness starts to emerge in consumer industries as well as some technology industries and healthcare industries, where margins tend to hold their power for the producers on the index, like the energy and materials companies and industrials companies. And then, of course, you have financials, which is kind of a completely different entity in this environment, but tends to do well when the yield curve is becoming more upward sloping as inflation conditions start to rise. So I think that's still the right sort of mix right now, is as you see margin pressures start to emerge with these inflation prints, as you see supply constraints continue to sort of weigh on margins for the index, you generally want to move toward producers and away from consumers. And that's beyond the U.S. market. When we run our global strategies, we see something very similar. Producer markets tend to do better in inflation relative to consumer markets. U.S., of course, is still a bigger consumer market than it is a producer market. So when you're thinking about international allocations, you would anticipate that non-domestic stocks would probably start to do a bit better than domestic stocks in an environment where inflationary conditions are becoming problematic for margins.
I want to talk about the consumer for a minute, because Wall Street is saying that as the economy starts up again, a lot of this money that's been sitting on the sidelines or in cash, consumers will start spending. What I found rather interesting over the last 12 months, Gina, is where consumers have been spending money. Big ticket items, you know, boat dealers are sold out, RV dealers are sold out. Cars are selling, homes are selling. So a lot of money went into what we would call big ticket items for consumers. You know, what about retail spending coming out of this?
Yeah, I think it's a really great question. And one that also kind of, if you want to go back to the comparison to the Great Financial Crisis, this one actually follows a typical recession pattern. Whereas after the Great Financial Crisis, remember I talked about the fact that leading into the Great Financial Crisis, you got to a point where households had overspent and were loaded up on debt and had to go through a period of time where they really couldn't take on any more debt. Even though interest rates were very low, they didn't have the capacity to spend on big ticket items, not only because they didn't have any cash, but because they had overloaded on debt. We're in the complete opposite scenario now, which is very typical following a normal recession, Great Financial Crisis excluded. The normal reaction function following a recession is households have cleansed their balance sheet during the recession period. They've had an opportunity to store up some degree of cash. They've saved because, you know, they're uncertain about economic conditions and interest rates are low. So they go out and start spending on big ticket items. We are seeing that so far in this recovery. Late 2020, we started to see that. We've seen it persist into 2021. I think it's a function of the fact that households are in better condition today than they have been in decades from a debt perspective. income is still growing as the employment markets improve. The federal government has obviously helicopter moneyed the economy, dumping cash on households. So there are a lot of reasons why you would expect consumer spending to be very robust. The problem that I think we're going to run into going into later this year and early next year is how much of that consumer spending gets eaten away by price increases. Because we are starting to see consumer prices accelerate. Obviously, as producer prices increase, they will pass much of that cost increase on to consumers. So when prices are inflating, they can buy less volume. And I do think that we're going to start to see the consequence of inflation eat away a little bit at the consumer going into 2022. We also are starting to see interest rates rise. And clearly, low interest rates, cost of borrowing money is extremely low and has been extremely low for the last year. That's going to start to go a little bit higher over the course of the next year. So I would anticipate a slight slowdown in consumer spending going into 2022. Very robust now because the conditions are still ripe. Cash is still high. But I do think when you're thinking about volume of consumption, a lot of factors would line up to suggest that we're going to see a slight slowdown in the pace of consumption growth going into the next year.
So at what point do you think, Gina, that the impact of higher inflation and higher taxes will start to impact both the markets and the economy?
Yeah, I think we're at that point now, frankly. I think we've seen the market trade sideways, sort of trend sideways in the U.S. for the last couple of months. We've been sort of caught in a range. Some days are better than others, but nonetheless, we've been stuck below our former peak. And I think we're going to be stuck there for a little while as we contend with these issues. And we also, frankly, consolidate extraordinary gains that we saw over the course of the last year. I think that the recovery in stocks certainly preceded the recovery in the economy. And it's not anomalous to see the equity market or Wall Street slow down as Main Street recovers. So our base case scenario for the rest of this year is sort of a sideways trending market that contends with a lot more volatility than we've seen in the recent past, a slight slowdown in earnings growth coming into 2022, not a nefarious, you know, negative environment created by inflation or taxes, certainly, but definitely a higher degree of volatility, which probably constrains price growth. It keeps the market trending and consolidating past gains for the interim.
So in the meantime, would you stay invested and just kind of ride this kind of volatility or sideways action? Or would you think it's time to get a little bit defensive and build some cash?
No, I would stay invested depending upon, you know, the type of investor and the time horizon we're talking about. There's no reason to anticipate that we're headed into a recession in the year ahead or a significant dip in growth. The risks are more risks on the margins that create a slowdown as opposed to a dip, a slowdown in the rate of appreciation, I should say, or a slowdown in the rate of growth. So we're still growing longer term. This does appear to be a longer term pause within an uptrend. You know, my prevailing assumption is we're not going to see any really negative downdraft, but if we do, it would most likely be an opportunity to add to equity positions in preparation for higher interest rates, potentially slightly higher inflation, and yet still strong growth coming in 2022, 2023.
All right. Well, listen, Gina, as we close, how can our listeners follow you? I follow you on a Bloomberg terminal. So how can the public find out more about what you do?
Well, the public can also get a Bloomberg terminal in an ideal situation. only a certain portion, probably, of the public. Nonetheless, if you are lucky enough to have access to a Bloomberg terminal, I'm at BI/STOX on the terminal, or you can just email me or IB me directly. If you do not have access to a Bloomberg terminal, then I do periodically post on LinkedIn and even less frequently on Twitter. But I'm Gina Martin Adams on both locations.
All right. Well, listen, Gina, as always, thanks for coming on the program. Stay safe and have a great summer.
Thank you. Thanks again for having me, and same to you.
The use of cash saw a precipitous decline during COVID. Likewise, we saw a rapid adoption of a number of different payment technologies, including contactless payments and others utilizing biometric information. This week, FS Insider spoke with Jody Kelly, the CEO of the Electronic Transactions Association, the largest organization covering payment processors throughout the world, to discuss the future of payments, the digital asset space, including crypto, but also central bank digital currencies and programmable money. Here's a clip of what she told listeners this week.
We are all creatures of habit, and people had a way of going about their lives that they were used to and comfortable with and didn't really have a reason to try to change. But COVID changed that. People started worrying about touching cash. They started worrying about touching things in stores, and they realized that they had, you know, mechanism at their disposal, tapping your phone to pay or tapping your card. And COVID was what gave people, you know, that impetus, the reason to try it. But once you try it and you figure out how to use it and you realize it's easy and, you know, it makes your life simpler, there's no going back.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, we've been talking about the precious metals markets. We've seen gold and silver rise this year, along with other assets. But what's going on with precious metals, especially silver and gold? How are the bullion doing compared to the stocks? Join us on the program is Mike McClone from Bloomberg and Jeff Christian from CPM Group. Gentlemen, one of the questions I'd like to put out there is we've seen silver go up, but if you try to get the actual bullion, and this question for either one of you, you know, people are paying anywhere from 25 to 30% premiums for, let's say, things like Silver Eagles or Maple Leafs. Can you explain what is causing this premium and why the disparity between the bullion actual commodity price and the coins?
The premium for a 1,000-ounce bar, which is a good delivery bar, the premium in the New York market is 2%. So it's up from 1.5% in previous years. There's clearly no tightness in the wholesale market. What you're seeing is that mints that make the Maple Leafs and the Eagles and others, and refineries that make non-coin, you know, small bars, 1 ounce rounds, 10 ounce bars, 100 ounce bars, they've all had logistical issues, really starting with the pandemic and the lockdown, and they have been constrained in production. And so there's a shortage of that kind of stuff. Now, let's explain that shortage a little bit more. 2017, 2018, 2019, investment demand for silver and gold was really down. If you look at silver, 40 million ounces a year, down from 150, 200 million ounces a year in 2008 to 2012. So the market, the business of making and marketing investment products contracted sharply. And the credit availability to those companies and refineries also contracted. While that was happening, because investors were backing away from gold and silver, you also had banks getting out of the provision of financial services to refineries and others. So you had a contraction in the capacity to respond to demand. Then in 2020, silver investment demand went from 40 million ounces to 80 million ounces. It doubled. And the price went from $15 to $25. So it went up, you know, 75%, whatever that is, 67%. You know, you had a sharp increase. The refiners say, we are now facing much sharper demand for our products. We need more credit to buy more inventory to process these materials. And it's not that we need to double it to meet the volume increase. We need to quadruple it because we need to meet the volume increase and the dollar value of that increase. So we need a lot more credit to buy metal to have working inventories to convert into investment size products. The banks say, I guess you didn't hear me when I told you that we're getting out of the precious metals business and you need to find a new bank. You know, and the idea of us going to our bosses who are saying, we don't want to stay in precious metals. We want to get out of precious metals. The idea of us going to them and say, well, there's a privately owned refinery that wants us to quadruple their credit lines because they need to bring in more gold and silver. It's not going to happen. So that's really one of the major constraints that you've seen that has caused a shortage of coins and small bars, which has pushed the premiums up.
Jeff, do you see that eventually the refiners will catch up with demand, or do you see this being in place because we're still facing financing issues, as you just brought out, or capacity constraints?
Yeah, you know, I was focusing on financial constraints because I'm a financial guy, but there have been a lot of physical and labor constraints too. And those labor and physical constraints can be fixed. But again, it takes capital to do that. You have to hire people. And these are very specialized businesses. You know, you don't just go out and hire somebody and say, hey, can you come in and stamp bars? You know, it's a very specialized problem. And the problem is that you never know how many coins or bars you need to make because of the fickle nature of investment demand. So you say, okay, it's gone to 80 million ounces. CPM Group might say, we're thinking that it might go to 100 million ounces of silver this year, but that's CPM Group's opinion, right? So you say, well, it could easily go back to 40, which is where it was for the last 3 years. So you have this great uncertainty. But we've written extensively over the last, I don't know, 6 or 9 months, that the reduction of the number of financial service companies offering financing for precious metals is reducing the depth and the breadth of liquidity in the market. And that's a quasi-permanent thing, that problem that is going to persist for a long time. And I'm not sure how it gets fixed or repaired.
Let's throw something else out. And I'd like to hear your opinion, Mike. One of the things about silver that makes it sort of unique, and I want to talk about the Green New Deal, the push towards green energy, where you use silver in, you know, I don't care if it's solar panels, windmills, and then I even want to move into copper. So let's talk about the demand aspects for silver outside of investment, but from an industrial side. I know, Jeff, at one time photography dominated silver, but with digital photography, that sort of went away. But let's talk about where silver is being used today and the impact that may have going forward with Green New Deal.
And the way I look at commodities and precious metals, most notably in silver and gold, is a little more macro, but I see silver as very likely to follow copper to a new high, get to near like $50 an ounce, and particularly based on the macro and the micro. I mean, the demand coming from this massive shift to decarbonization, electrification, digitalization, all favors silver. I mean, I've sold panels, they have silver in them, they work great. And within 10, 20 years, I think every structure that's built in the planet will have solar connectivity. They might have panels, it might be directly from the actual shingles, they might be solar roofs, but it's just a matter, it's just logical because it's getting cheaper. But I look at it as one of the primary commodities I see don't have very little downside. It, you know, with the currency debasement and the macro, silver is right in the space, closer to copper. But the problem I have when I look at things like gold now is I cannot look at gold anymore without analyzing Bitcoin. And I can't analyze Bitcoin without analyzing, like, that's out roping in Ethereum. It's just how things are, where things are flowing. And I see fundamental shifts kicking in. So silver I view is, like I said, I think it's bottom, you know, that's 25 levels, pretty low. It should break above 30 eventually and get to 50. It's a question of time and how we get there. And I'd rather not lose too much here trying to narrow down nuances. But I think it's a very important part of all portfolios, particularly when people are talking about this commodity super cycle. I look at it like, what are you missing about that? What's happening in petroleum? You can't really invest in petroleum unless you want to crush yourself with eventually rolling into contango, which it always will do. And it's being arbed away. There's massive supply and demand is declining. All that means demand for metals, most particularly the precious gold, silver, platinum, palladium, copper's in there. It's just hard to invest in copper.
Let me throw this out. And you brought up a good point, Mike, and I'd like to get both your inputs on this. In the 00 decade, we saw the advent of ETFs for silver and for gold. It made it very convenient to just buy an ETF with a click versus go to a coin shop. Now we have another investment category. We'll call it the cryptos. How much has crypto impacted the rise of gold or silver?
To me, my simple analysis showed gold right now should be $2,500 an ounce if it wasn't for all the flows into crypto just this year alone. Simply looking at the copper-gold ratio overlaid with 10-year bond yields, 10-year yields, whatever fiber, whatever you want to use, depending on how far back you want to go back, 5-10 years. And it also, to me, is just a normal uptick for a year, 30%. Gold around 2,600 makes a lot of sense. The key thing is, you know, we can show all the demo, I can show all the flows, and it's not really into Bitcoin anymore. And there's massive flows into Ethereum. And I think that's just becoming prudent. People do not want to miss out. They don't want the risk of becoming a Kodak or a Blockbuster or Sears. They have to get involved with this, what's happening. And, you know, anybody's holding gold all knows. To me, it's just a prudent thing to do to have part of that portfolio in Bitcoin. The key point is there will be ETFs on Bitcoin. It's a matter of time. I published on that this morning. It's a fact that Bitcoin futures now have greater volume and more depth and liquidity than wheat futures. And there's wheat ETFs. So that's a baby step. But there's going to be ETFs launched on Bitcoin futures. Now, it might be a baby step. It's not the physical, but the SEC has no excuse now. They're in Canada. They're in Europe, most notably Switzerland. I mean, who knows money better than Switzerland? It's just a matter of time in the U.S. So that's a massive dangling carrot from the portfolios of the world to be able to push a brokerage button and go right into an ETF that tracks Bitcoin. Yes, it's not the physical, but it's the baby step to get to the actual. So these are iterations I'm looking forward to of bullishness, which means flows are going that way. And that's why I say when I look at precious metals, I think it's remiss. It's actually irresponsible to not have Bitcoin and cryptos in the same bucket because of what's happening. And you have to expect trends to end. I'm just kind of simplistic. Jeff's smarter on these things. I just look at the trends and say, okay, what's it going to make it end versus continuing?
I'm not sure that I'm smart, but I'm orthodox. And you know, let me say, I disagree with Mike on cryptos. And our view is that cryptos have distracted some investment money away from gold and silver, but the real distraction has been away from gold and silver into the stock market and to some extent the bond market, because that's where most of the money has flowed. You know, cryptos are still relatively small compared to precious metals. And precious metals are relatively small compared to stocks and bonds. And stocks and bonds have just gone from strength to strength for the last 11 years, thanks to monetary accommodation and fiscal stimulus. So I think that that's there. Now, my orthodoxy is this. I didn't invest in tech stocks in 1998 to 2000. And I didn't lose 90% of my money or 100% of my money when they blew up in 2001. And, you know, I have been known to call cryptocurrencies pet rocks, but they're much more like the tech stocks that blew up in 2001. They're, if you will, empty shells. Now, there were 6 or 10 tech stock companies that survived and became major corporations, but there were thousands that investors lost money on. And I believe that private cryptocurrencies ultimately will deliver the same results for investors in them. So we're telling, you know, I have no cryptocurrencies. I have no interest in cryptocurrencies. Most of my clients don't have interest in cryptocurrencies. If they do, they buy and sell gold as a long-term investment, and they trade cryptos on a day basis, and they go home flat because they fully expect that one day they're going to wake up and oops, they're gone. Now, I do think that cryptocurrencies have a future as national currencies. And there's all of this nonsense that you hear on the internet about the great currency reset, which is like marketeers trying to scare investors into gold and silver. It's not a matter of an international currency reset. It's a matter of a modernization of the currency system. The idea of distributed ledger protocol and a cashless society is incredibly attractive to a lot of people. And I think that that's the way it's going to go. But I think that the cryptocurrencies that are around 5 years from now, 10 years from now, are going to be national currencies. And, you know, I shouldn't say it with my COVID haircut, but I think people are going to look back at cryptocurrencies and say, well, that was as smart as the mullet I had in the 1970s.
Yeah. So, Jeff, I bet you're the first buyer of Dogecoin then.
No, I'm not. Yes, I'm using it to level my table. Because it doesn't actually exist. I'm sorry. That's a piece of cardboard.
Let me throw something out. We saw with the Colonial Pipeline hacking, the hackers got paid in Bitcoin. So you now have the government talking about coming in and regulating. Got the IRS that wants any transaction of more than 10,000 to be reported, because a lot of people, you know, they trade in and out of their cryptos, and who's paying tax on that? So what about the impact of government regulation on cryptos? What, Mike, I'm going to go to you on this. What impact do you think that'll have?
Well, it's, first of all, this is an ideal topic because it's becoming the center of the new Cold War. So let's start with the world's most widely traded cryptocurrency is Tether. Tether is a digital dollar. 30-day average volume is $180 billion. It's double the volume of Bitcoin. It trades mostly in Asia, and it's organic. It's not regulated yet. It's coming. And the key fact is it's happening organically and digital. People want to trade the dollar. They want it. And guess what? Tether is an Ethereum token. So you want value? To me, that's where you see the building block from Ethereum. So I completely agree with Jeff. There's massive speculation in this space. There's a few that are going to win. And right now, Ethereum is crushing it because it's the platform for everything. So I'm going there because of regulation. Is you can't regulate much open source software, the world's largest decentralized network, which is Bitcoin. You can. But the key thing that's happening, the fact that China and Iran are pushing it out means the U.S. is more likely to embrace it. But we have already. We have Ethereum futures. We have Bitcoin futures. Coinbase has just gone public. The trend is clearly there. So if the U.S. does nothing, this whole narrative of dollar dominance and CBDCs and China taking over in terms of currency is completely wrong. Dollar dominance is increasing organically, digitally, in a world that's going digital based on what I mentioned, just one Ethereum token, that's Tether. So the U.S. is probably going to regulate there. I mean, you can consider it counterfeit at the moment, but I think what the U.S. has done to its banks and primary dealers, regulated and just control it, tax it, make some money on it. Definitely got to tax any capital gains in cryptos, but to me, that's where it's coming. But the next key step of regulation is a virtual guarantee. We're going to get an ETF. I say that because if you're bullish or bearish, that means a massive amount of capital will flow into the space, most notably Bitcoin. So regulation's coming. The U.S. is smart enough, I think, to embrace the technology, partly because it's becoming the center of the global Cold War. China's losing, by the way, and America's winning by doing nothing at the moment. And it's pointing out the major, major issues with China. China, no free flow of capital, no open discourse, and a major issue with capital flight. I mean, the key question you ask yourself, do you know, have you ever met anybody who wants to immigrate to China? And what's happening in Hong Kong now? Everybody wants to get the heck out.
Well,
and they
I'm
want to take the money with them.
Mike, so I may want to go there.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's 12% taxes. I'm in the process right now moving to Florida. 0% taxes compared to what I pay here, 7%. And that's local. So simple thing. It's a simple fact. But to quote Kathy Wood, I'll point out what she said when I interviewed her on the Bloomberg Crypto Summit is no legislator in the U.S. wants to be known as the person who messed up the next best thing.
It's interesting because I've talked to some people in government, not just the U.S., but other governments. And it's one of these themes that you see on the dark corners of the internet, that the government's going to come in and regulate cryptos and regulate them to death. And what I have picked up universally as government attitudes toward private cryptos is we don't want to regulate them. We don't want to be the guys who muck it up. But we're very confident that if we just leave them alone, they will destroy themselves. So they don't necessarily like private cryptos, but they're confident that they will go away without the government having to push them aside. And I think that that's a real thing, you know. And just for the record, I was preparing to move to China before the trade war started. Since that time, my wife has said, well, I'd hate to have to divorce you, but I'm not moving to China. I mean, two, 3 years ago, she was saying, yeah, I could see that, you know, move to Shanghai for a while. But things have deteriorated so drastically, domestically in China, domestically in the United States, and between the United States and China, and between the United States and every other country just about on Earth, including the EU and the UK and Canada and Mexico, that, you know, I think that immigration away from here is probably not in the offing now. So I think that cryptos are a problem, not a solution. And I think that the government will take a hands-off approach, figuring that they'll fix their own problem.
Just come spawn on one thing real quick, just on that, as far as problems. There's a guy who sits right behind me. He's from Zimbabwe. He likes Bitcoin. I wonder why.
Let's go back to fundamentals for a second. We've got the macro environment, interest rates. You know, what is a three-month T-bill, 4 or 5 basis points? We've got the government spending money like drunken sailors. I mean, you know, what's the deficit this year? $3.3 trillion. We've got another $4 trillion in the works of possible stimulus. So we got that factor. And then another on the industrial side, we've got this green energy where you're using silver for windmills, for solar panels, copper for cars. I mean, I just look at, I want to switch here a bit to copper, because you take a look at an EV. I've got one on order. It's going to use 4 times the amount of copper that a regular car uses. Then you talk about the charging stations that they're going to have to put in place. That's going to use copper. And then, you take a look at even building in the homes. It just strikes me here in California, we have a shortage of housing. And our definition of a millionaire in California is a homeowner.
Well, that's what they said during the Weimar Republic in Germany, too. Anybody who owned property thought they were getting rich.
Yeah. So let's talk about the fundamentals of both silver and copper in this kind of new, green environment that we're moving into.
So I'm bullish both. And I like to point out that I own an EV, but I have an EV that's much more appropriate for the current infrastructure. I have a Chevy Volt. It's basically a public plug-in hybrid. I've had it for 6 years. It's awesome. And when you drive that thing, I realize everything's going that way. And that's nascent technology. It's just a matter of time. This new Ford 150, once you drive one of these things, and once they get to, you know, easily 500 miles per charge and charge in 15 minutes, it's just a matter of time. And then, as Kathy Wood said, the cost of a typical EV in this country will drop below that of an IC, an internal combustion engine, about 5 years was her estimate. Just a matter of time. It's all going that way, which means demand for copper. The key thing also about copper supply is not really coming on, and it's becoming political, as Jeff will probably expand on what's happening with Peru and Chile with resource nationalism kicking in. So the key thing I would say about copper is if you're bullish commodities, copper has to stay above $10,000 a ton. It absolutely has to, because there's virtually no chance crude oil is going above there. Virtually no chance corn is going much higher, because you have massive elasticity supply, and those sectors are so easy. The only place it's really not have major elasticity of supply is in the metals, most notably copper and silver. And then, of course, you mentioned all the currency debasement. But I'll end on this, and I'll pass over to Jeff. I like to point out that this is one of the most deflationary periods in the history of mankind, most notably in the back of technology. And here's an example. Copper at $10,000 a ton is the same price it was in 2011. Just imagine if we said something like that about the stock market. I bet we'd have negative rates right now in the bond, like we have in Germany. That'd be massively deflationary. It's all this pumping of money that's just keeping up with this rapidly advancing technology, which is increasing the supply of petroleum. Here's another fact. The actual total production of liquid fuels in this country has doubled in the last 20 years. And guess what consumption does? It's flat. It's unchanged. And that's before EVs. That's just rapidly advancing technology. It's just because of enhanced efficiency. Where is that going? The whole world is going to follow the U.S. example. They might not get the production, but the demand for liquid fuels is going to start declining. A guarantee. It's just going to follow the U.S. And we've been somewhat in, yes, we have this COVID thing, but you know, what about COVID did anything to increase the demand for liquid fuels? Nothing. So I switch back to the metals and point out, to me, this is why you have to be, as a prudent investor, having some allocation to the metals, How you do it is a different way. Jeff will probably help with the equities. And partly because at some point, when we do get a bit of mean reversion in the stock market, I didn't say F, that will point out how deflationary things really are. And I'll end on one thing. As I look at corn, was up 50% in the year just a few months ago, the average price of corn. If you just look at the DEES contract, which is going to be expiring in a month, it's almost flat on the year from the front price, which means by the end of the year, the narrative, I think, is corn is going to be transitory, meaning the price is up 50%. It ended up flat.
I've got some different views, and I'm probably less bullish on copper, both in the short term and the long term. And I'll try to get into that. And there are several things that are going on. And unfortunately, it's a little bit premature. I've been wanting to pull together some data on copper, and I've just been so distracted with gold and silver that I haven't had my colleagues and I have just not had the time to do this. But I'll throw out a couple things. And first, I just love holding this up. This is the book that I wrote in 1979 on electric cars.
I love those pictures.
I love those pictures too. Because in 1979, electric cars were about to take off.
Yeah, right.
So this book is
like artificial intelligence too.
Yeah, the solar power. I was looking at solar power, wind power. And the gist of this book and my research into solar power and wind power in 1970s was these things are decades away from being commercially viable. I'm getting into metals. And now it's decades later and they're commercially viable. With solar power, there's one thing I'll point out. Yes, solar power is just going to grow and grow and grow. But one of the things that we've been warning our clients about as long-term investors with exposure to silver, which is now starting to emerge, is end-of-life recycling of solar panels. And you're starting to see that. There's always been recycling of new process. You know, as you make solar panels, a certain number of them don't work out and they get recycled. So the industry to recycle silver and recover silver and copper from solar panels has been there for a decade. And now you're starting to see end of life panels come off and get recycled. That's not going to cause the solar industry to use less silver on a gross basis, on a net basis, but it will reduce the amount of new silver that it needs because some of the stuff will be coming in. With copper, I have a couple of things. And you know, Bloomberg New Energy Finance has always been much more bullish about the rate of market penetration for electric vehicles than I have been. And even within CPM Group, the analyst, you know, we have these Talmudic discussions about the growth rate, market penetration of electric vehicles. But there are certain constraints to bringing in electric vehicles too fast. The ability to make them, the ability to make all of the components and materials that go into them, the sufficient electricity, a stable enough electrical grid. And I think that those things will cause electric vehicles to come in a little bit more slowly than a lot of people think. But the other thing is that you've got the old reserves resources thing. And this is a ghost that has plagued commodity bulls since the early 70s. They look at reserves and they say, we don't have good enough reserves. We don't have enough reserves to meet future demand. But resources, which are mineralized deposits that are not economically viable at current or recent prices, but could reasonably be expected to become economically viable. Known resources are equivalent to 100 years worth of copper production demand at current levels. And inferred resources are equal to like another 160 years. So there's a lot of metal out there. And if the price stays at $10,000 a ton or moves higher, that stuff becomes viable. Now, whether or not the mining industry is smart enough and agile enough to mine it, and resource nationalism definitely is a major factor, and environmentalism and ESG and all these other factors all factor in limiting the ability to get it. But in the long run, there's a lot of copper out there in the ground still. And there's even more copper above the ground in scrap. I mean, if you take a train from New York City to Washington, you go through everybody's backyards. And most of those backyards are actually junkyards full of old steel and old automobiles and old scrap, a lot of which has copper. So I think that there, you know, I've said it. I said it 14 years ago, and I'm saying it again today. The commodity super cycle is marketing hype. It's economics 101 that matters. What's the supply? What's the demand? What's the price? You hear people talking, well, you know, the grades of silver and copper are falling because the world's running out of copper and silver. No, the grades of copper and silver being mined are falling because the prices are rising. Yeah. Yeah. You know, when you have a higher price, you don't have to high grade to stay in business. You can mine a lower grade and make more money. And you're seeing that in the copper industry, and you're seeing that in the silver industry. And there's a lot of misunderstanding behind the hype, you know, and like I said, you know, I wish I've had the time to do the copper in-depth study that we want to do, but we just haven't had the time to do it because the markets are also volatile right now. But my view is that I would be extremely cautious about being a perma bull on copper.
Finally, guys, let me ask you this. Given the macro environment, where we are now, what the Fed is doing, when it comes to precious metals, what would you advise investors to do? Would you take a small position or just have a minimal position? Would you do stocks? Would you do the bullion? Input from both of you.
Well, I have to be careful with investor advice. I'll just point out, I fully expect precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, platinum, some of the best performing commodities in the future. I include Bitcoin and Ethereum in that bucket. I think it's remiss not to. I do fully expect at some point when we get a stock market mean reversion, means a period of underperformance, which we haven't had since the financial crisis. I mean, that correction last year, that was just a dip in the trend. Then we fully expect these deflationary trends to kick in, Fed yields to continue to plunge, which the key thing that's really pushing back gold this year is crude oil going up and yields going up. So once that reverses, which I didn't say if, gold should be a primary beneficiary, metal should be a primary beneficiary. And so I look at that ratio to continue. Gold continue to rise, crude oil continue to decline. That's what's really been happening for most of the last decade. So as far as your portfolio, I'll end on this. I think it's, and Jeff and I obviously have to disagree. If not, we're not doing our jobs. I think it's almost irresponsible not to have some cryptos in there, most notably maybe the Bloomberg Galaxy Crypto Index.
The primary factor, the factor that has, if you look at econometric studies of gold and silver prices, you see that the thing that has the greatest influence is investment demand, changes in investment demand for obvious reasons. And then you say, well, what drives investment demand for gold and silver? And there are six sets of factors, mostly macroeconomic and political factors. Five of those are flashing red and have been flashing red for some time right now. So that tells us that you have an economic and political environment that's telling investors to have more gold and more silver rather than less. Now, what our preferred means is to have a diversified precious metals portfolio. So yes, physical gold and silver as a long-term insurance policy, as a wealth preservation program, but also to be aware that these prices go up and down. So, you know, don't you see the price of gold, silver go from $27 to $30 to $32? You don't necessarily sell your silver, but maybe you buy some puts. And then when the price falls back to $28, which it's done three times since last July, you sell those puts back. You take some profits out and you still have silver at $28. Actually, you've reduced your annual price. And it's very funny because you have these people caught, this guy contacted me yesterday. Well, I tell you, Jeff, the silver market's manipulated and the price can't get over $28 tomorrow. So I sent them an email. I said, okay, got up to $28.34, and it's still above $28 when we were talking earlier this morning. So does this mean that your conspiracy theory is nonsense? And, have you actually finally realized that what you think you know doesn't actually exist? And he said, no. They'll slam it down at 30. I'll bet you a cup of coffee that it slams down. They slam it down at 30. I said, I can't take that bet because our view is the price is going to rise to 30 and then come back off. It has nothing to do with whoever they are. slamming the market down. It has everything to do with the way the silver market works. And if you look since last July, we've gotten up to $25, $9.50, $30 three times. And each time, oh, the roll is over and the price comes back off. So you can bet your bottom dollar that the price of silver can rise and it can also fall. And when you see the price rise, you should try to profit from the volatility in silver. And the same is true with copper and the same is true with gold. So we like physical metal, but we also like trading and we like options for trading. And then, yes, equities are sometimes very interesting too as longer term investments.
All right, guys. Well, listen, as we close, Mike, if our listeners would like to follow you at Bloomberg, tell them how you can do so. And likewise with you, Jeff.
Link in with me. Happy to link in with most people. I'm on Twitter, Mike McGlone 11. I just don't respond much to Twitter, but I'm active on LinkedIn partly because of the professional connection with Bloomberg. So happy to do it with a lot of people. And if you want to get on my list, just link in and ask.
All right. Thanks. Jeff?
www.cpmgroup.com is our website. We're doing these weekly videos that are available on YouTube. info@cpmgroup is the best way to reach me. Simply because I do have a Twitter account that people complain I never answer their questions. That's because I don't look at it. I don't even know who created it. You know, somebody somewhere at CPM Group created a Twitter account, and I guess they monitor it. I have a LinkedIn account, but I don't like to use LinkedIn because it's much more cumbersome than emails. So if people send questions and comments to info@cpmgroup.com, that gets dealt with much more likely. If not by me, somebody else says, hey, Jeff, this came in. You really have to pay attention to it.
Well, listen, gentlemen, all the best to you. Have a great day, great week, and thanks for coming on the program.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth advisory team, which has been servicing clients for over 35 years, feel free to give us a call at 888-486-3939. Also, don't forget to tell your friends and family about our podcast, Financial Sense News Hour, to stay on top of the latest developments in the market and how they impact your investments. Lastly, if you aren't already a subscriber and would like to listen to more of our premium content airing 3 days during the week through our website or through an app on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.